You are listening to continuing coverage of the trial of Chad Daybell from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Let's go back to the courtroom.
Thank you. Please be seated. All right. Good morning, everyone. We're back on the record on CR 2221-1623, State of Idaho versus Chad Guy Daybell, continuing with the defense case in chief. And if you're ready, Mr. Pryor, we'll go ahead and have the jurors brought in.
Yes, Your Honor.
Here's all present count for Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bailiff. Please be seated. All right. Good morning, everyone. We are on the record on case CR 2221-1623, State of Idaho versus Chad Guy Daybell. We're continuing at this time with the defense case in chief. The court will note all of the jurors have returned and are present. The court's also received the juror affirmation signed by each of the jurors. So thank you again for continuing to follow the court's admonishing instruction as we break each day. At this time, I believe the defense is prepared to call its next witness. Mr. Pryor, if you'd like to call your next witness, you may do so. Yes. Okay. If you'll give us just a minute, we need to get our FTR working. All right. We're ready to proceed, Mr. Pryor.
Judge, the defense would call Dr. Eric Bartling.
Solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Can I help you with that?
I do.
Thank you.
May I, Judge?
Yes, and Mr. Pryor, as I understand it, this would be testimony offers as an expert witness. Is that correct?
It is, Your Honor.
Okay. I will not inquire then on the court's exclusionary order. So if you'd like to commence with your direct examination, Mr. Pryor, you may.
Would you please state your name, spell your last name for the record for me, please?
Yes, my name is Eric Bartling, E-R-I-C. Bartling is B-A-R-T-E-L-I-N-K.
And how are you employed, sir?
I'm a professor of anthropology at Chico State University and co-director of the Human Identification Laboratory.
And what is the Human Identification Laboratory?
The Human Identification Laboratory is a forensic anthropology facility, and we provide services to law enforcement throughout the state of California on the recovery and analysis of human skeletal remains related to death scenes and crime scenes.
And talk to me a little bit about what is forensic anthropology.
So forensic anthropology is a subspecialization of biological anthropology. And it's specifically focused on the analysis of human skeletal remains, including things like estimating sex, age, ancestry, stature, and also things like defects on remains related to trauma. Identification methods and scene recovery of human remains.
Now, you mentioned identification. Would that include situations where there's been suspected burning of the corpse?
The identification part's more about establishing the identity of a deceased person, but we do specialize in the study of burned remains and other postmortem alterations to the body.
Can you tell me a little bit about your educational background?
Yes, I have a BS in anthropology from Central Michigan University, a master's in anthropology from Chico State University, a PhD in anthropology from Texas A&M University.
Are there certain board certifications that you are required to participate in as part of this specialty?
Although it's not required, it's strongly recommended that practitioners become board certified. And I am board certified by the American Board of Forensic Anthropology since 2012.
Okay. Are there any affiliations or organizations that you're associated with or participate with?
There are several. And while these are not qualifications, these are indicate participation in the field. So I am a fellow of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, and I am the chair of the Organization of Scientific Area Committees Forensic Anthropology Subcommittee.
And how long have you engaged in the practice of forensic anthropology?
I have been involved with forensic anthropology for about 22 years.
Have you done any publications or research?
Yes, I have published many articles and book chapters, as well as books related to forensic anthropology and other areas of biological anthropology.
And in regards of training of your specialty in terms of fire-caused issues related to the burning and fire, what sort of training have you had in that capacity?
So, throughout my education, I have learned about burned human remains through coursework and trainings and workshops. But I have personally assisted on over 100 burned remains cases. I assisted with like World Trade Center identification efforts, which involved a lot of burned remains. And so, and our team is the main team who does fire victim recovery for wildfire victims in the state of California.
Okay. Now, you spoke previously about part of your organization is to help law enforcement agencies. Is it primarily your position in aiding law enforcement agencies, or do you help in defense cases as well?
We don't discriminate between whether we work with the prosecution or the defense. So we have assisted the defense in cases where we thought we could provide useful information and perspective about a case.
Okay. And how have you testified before in front of a court?
I have.
And how many times have you done that?
I think it's around 7 or 8 times. And then I've had other depositions.
Okay. And I think I've asked this before, but I'll ask it again. Is there any specialized knowledge or training that you would be required to have as part of your title as a forensic anthropologist?
Yes, you'd have to be a specialist in the anatomy and biology of the human skeleton. You would have to be able to identify postmortem alterations, including burning on human remains, and be able to properly categorize those modifications. And you have to have expertise in how to identify evidence of skeletal trauma on human remains.
Okay. Judge, I previously had marked Defense Exhibit 136. My understanding, and I won't speak for the state, but my understanding is the state has no objection to the admission of 136.
We do not, Your Honor.
All right. And Exhibit 136 then is offered and admitted. Can you explain what the exhibit is, Mr. Pryor?
The exhibit is Dr. Bartelink's report, Judge.
Thank you.
And Judge, for ease of use, and for me and probably everybody else, I'd like to utilize the ELMO. My understanding is the state has a copy of the very document as well. And I'd like, for purposes of publication, to use the ELMO device to publish.
Okay. If you'd like to publish a conforming printed copy of the exhibit on the ELMO without objection from, if there is no objection from the state, you can publish it that way.
Your Honor, we have no objection to that.
All right.
Now, Dr. Bartelink, you were contacted by my office for what purpose?
We were asked to analyze the skeletal remains of Tylee Ryan.
Okay. And I'd like you to go through the process of what steps you took to conduct that review and investigation.
Yeah, so me and my colleagues, Dr. Colleen Milligan and Ashley Kendall, came up to Rexburg, Idaho, and did an analysis of Tylee's remains on December 18th. We worked with the Rexford Police Department to unpack Tylee Ryan's remains and to sort them into anatomical position on a table so that we could conduct an analysis. We performed an inventory, which is a tabulation of all of the bones that were present. We also filled in a skeletal diagram indicating which portions of Tylee's remains were present and absent. Because she was already identified, we did not conduct estimations of sex, age, etc. But we did conduct a trauma analysis by examining each bone to look for any kind of defects or modifications. And we also recorded the pattern of burning across the skeleton.
And the length of time in order for you to do this was approximately how long?
We conducted this in the span of 1 day, and it was 3 forensic anthropologists working together. And so we were able to conduct that work in approximately a 6 to 7 hour period between the 3 of us.
Okay. So 18 hours of between the 3 of you, approximately.
Total of about 6 to 7 hours with us working all together simultaneously as a team. Okay.
So the 3 of you were all engaged in work at the same time, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So, and those folks were associates with your organization, is that correct?
Yes, they are professors that work with me in the Human Identification Lab and are professors at Chico State University.
Both PhDs?
Correct.
And both have similar experience and training as you have, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Now, as part of your review and investigation, you prepared a report. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And I'm not going to go into every word in the report, but in essence, as part of your investigation, what did you discover in regards to the inventory of the remains?
We found that there were certain areas of Tally Ryan's remains that were absent, and this included large parts of the vertebral column, most of the left and right arms, and large portions of the legs, kind of from mid-thigh down towards the ankle on at least one of the legs.
And Judge, could I utilize the Elmo device at this point?
Yes.
So I'm showing you a illustration from your report, and there is a laser pointer up there somewhere, if you can find it. And then off to your left is a large screen. And if you could just go through in general, the areas that you found were not present at the burial site of Tally Ryan, and just basically describe each one for me, if you would.
So the way that this skeletal diagram is labeled is on the left side is a front view of the skeleton, and on the right side is a back view. Anything that's colored in black was absent, which means we could not identify those portions of the body in the inventory. So we're missing a little bit of the skull from the left eye socket, a little bit here from the back of the skull. And then if we move down towards the limbs, we're missing almost all of the right arm, except for just the shoulder and a small piece of this forearm bone right here. We're missing almost the entire left arm, except for the shoulder. We are missing most of the ribs, but we were not able to label those individually because we could not determine which rib was which because they were burned and fragmented.
Okay, I'd have to you stop there for just a moment, and please forgive my interruption, but when you say fragments of the ribs, is it your testimony that the majority of the rib cage was missing?
I wouldn't say the majority, but a large portion of the ribs were not represented in the inventory.
Okay.
Mr. Pryor, I apologize for the interruption. Could I have a quick sidebar with counsel, please?
Excuse me, doctor. Judge, may I proceed?
All right. Yes. Apologies for that interruption on the sidebar. You can continue, Mr. Pryor.
So I think we were at the last we let off. We talked about, I think my comment was the majority of the rib cage, but you said instead it was a large portion of them.
That is correct.
Okay. And then can you continue with your pointing out the different remains that you were unable to locate?
Yes. So as we move down, we can see that from about the mid-thigh area, these are the femur bones, all the way down to just a little bit of the top of the shin bone here, the tibia bone. No bones could be found from those areas. And we had a little bit of the right leg here, missing this section down here. And then on the left leg, we have almost nothing represented from that leg, except for a few small fragments. So we're missing probably large portions of the skeleton.
You're missing large portions of the skeleton.
That is correct.
Now, you are an expert in the area of forensic anthropology, and you mentioned that you are involved in the recovery as it relates to wildfire victims in California as well. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And that you have, I don't know how to talk to you about this, but the part of your job is scientific testing of remains and the impact that they can have with fire. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And you conduct experiments in that regard, right?
We have done some training exercises, and colleagues of mine have as well, where we have experimentally burned a willed body donor.
Okay, and I'm going to stop you there. What that is in a situation where someone has identified on their donor card that they would be willing to be part of a testing, a scientific testing, and that's how you obtain the body to engage in your testing. Is that correct?
That is correct, and these are for training exercises for law enforcement and for search and rescue personnel.
Okay. And explain to me the process of what you did to run these tests of the will donor body.
So these tests typically involve kind of building a what sort of looks like a funeral pyre out of pallets.
Okay, and when you say a funeral pyre, are we talking about a small brush fire?
It's usually multiple pallets, probably around four or five
pallets.
Yeah, to create enough fuel to burn the body.
So this is a large fire.
Correct.
Would the expression a bonfire be appropriate?
Yes, it would be, you know, similar in size to a large bonfire.
Okay. And would it be possible?
Your Honor, at this point, I'd like to make an objection and ask for a quick sidebar.
All right, we'll have a sidebar. All right, at this time, the court's determined we need to make a evidentiary ruling and do that outside the presence of the jurors before we proceed further with this. So the jurors will be asked to just please stand up if you would and line up out in the hall, and we don't need a full break. I don't think this will take very long to get through, but we do need to take up that matter, and I think the most efficient way is to do that. So apologies for the inconvenience, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, but if we could have you please exit the courtroom, we'll take up this evidentiary matter.
All right, please.
All right, thank you. Please be seated. All right, Mr. Wixom, I understand the state had an objection to this stage of the testimony. If you'd like to lodge the objection, you may.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You can go ahead. I understood the state was proposing an objection to this particular line of questioning.
We are, Your Honor, and for the record, we are objecting the line of questioning with regard to the experiment that it appears the witness is attempting to go into. The basis for the objection, Your Honor, is that while we did receive a 27-page report from this expert, nowhere in the report that I can see did it reference the particular experiment that's being talked about. The biggest concern the state has is under Rule 16, we're entitled to have a summary report of his conclusions, including the data and facts upon which he relied. When we received this report, we provided it to our two experts and had them look at the report in preparation for their own testimony. Certainly, I'm prepared here today to respond to and to deal with the conclusions in the summary report as provided, but we didn't have an opportunity to have our experts consider the way and the methodology that he may have used in this experiment we didn't know about in preparation for a potential cross-examination here, nor in preparation for the calling of our own witnesses. And so for that reason, as to the line of questioning, any reference to any experiment, we would object to that being admitted at this time.
All right. And if you'll give me a moment, I'm just briefly reviewing through the report. And so that was admitted as Defense Exhibit 136. And your proffer to the court here, Mr. Wixom, is that contained within that 27-page report, there's no mention of an experiment regarding fires. Is that what you're saying?
That's my understanding, Judge. And I believe that's been confirmed off the record.
All right. Response, Mr. Pryor.
Judge, this was part of a training exercise to show how he analyzed and determined burn marks, deciding when and where a corpse and how it was burned. So if the court would like me to rephrase it, instead of rephrasing it as an experiment, I can rephrase it as a training in order to help aid him and his organization in making the determinations that they do as part of this. I'm not suggesting in any way at this point the manner and type in which the remains of Tylee Ryan were burned. What I'm suggesting, Judge, is this was a training exercise that his organization engages in as part of his wildfire training, and that he's describing that this is the methodology that they use to do that in this particular isolated incident. I don't think it's necessary in that situation. This report would be 100 pages if I had to put in every training exercise this expert has engaged in to gain the knowledge that he has.
Okay, so to be clear here, there you're referencing as part of foundation or his basis of expertise that he's done this type of training before, but what you are not intending to proffer here is some specific evidence relating to a scientific experiment that would apply to the remains in this case. Is that what I'm understanding?
That's absolutely right, Judge. This is a foundational question that deals with Dr. Bartling's experience in how he makes determinations in terms of of folks who are victims of fire.
Okay. Any further argument or response from the state?
Judge, with that proffer, the state would withdraw the objection. It wasn't referenced in the report, so we didn't have a proper understanding. But if it's limited to that purpose, we withdraw the objection.
Okay. And I would find it proper in terms of foundational for expertise to be established under Rule 702. And so with the state withdrawing that, we'll go ahead. If that's where the testimony's heading, Mr. Pryor, we'll let the jurors back in. Of course, if it were going into a realm of some specific experiment that took place relating to the evidence in this case, then likely the objection could be renewed, and I would then issue a further ruling.
And Judge, for clarity with the jury, I think what I will do is rephrase experiment, and with the defense or with the state's permission, I'll use the word training. And that might alleviate any confusion the state might have with where I was going.
Okay. And I think that would help clarify things. So thank you, counsel. We'll go ahead and have the jurors brought back in, and you can continue with your line of questioning, Mr. Pryor.
Thank you.
All right. Please, President.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bailiff. Please be seated. All right, Mr. Pryor, if you'd like to continue on your direct, you may.
All right. And Judge, I'll start with Dr. Bartolink. We were talking about a training that you were participating in terms of utilizing a donor, a willing donor, and engaging in the intentional burning of that donor for purposes of scientific training. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a part of a training course.
Okay. And can you elaborate on what that encompassed?
So essentially setting up something that would be similar to a funeral pyre, but having multiple pallets stacked and cutting out sections of those pallets. So you'd have a pallet underneath the donor as well as on top. And we're trying to achieve a certain level of burning in the study. And so it requires the use of a fair amount of fuel source. In this case, it was the wood pallets.
Okay. And when you're talking about a fair amount of fuel source, is that a significant amount of fuel source?
You need combustible materials. And so a body does not easily burn without having combustible materials. And so using wood is an effective way of achieving a large fire to reduce a body's mass down to the bones.
You used the expression funeral pyre. That would suggest a sizable fire.
Yeah, like a large bonfire.
Okay. And would the use of just gasoline, would that obtain the same result?
So typically accelerants don't generate enough fuel. They burn away quickly, so they don't generate enough fuel to sustain combustion of a human body for a long period of time. So usually you need other types of combustible materials.
And in regards to a funeral pyre as such, so if I understand you correctly, just the use of gasoline on a donor corpse would not achieve the burning to obtain the results you're looking for.
In my experience, no.
Okay. It would have to require a significant amount of when you say, I think you used the term fuel, that would be wood?
Could be wood or other types of combustible materials.
Okay. Okay. Something that would burn easily.
That's correct.
In a large quantity.
That's correct.
To generate a significant fire.
Yes.
Over a long, prolonged period of time.
Yes.
To obtain the same result.
Yes.
Okay. Now, I'd like to go back, if we could utilize the Elmo again, Judge.
Yes, you may.
You pointed out in black on this illustration all of the remains that were not present when you did your review and investigation. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Would the use of a fire be the explanation as to why you didn't have a complete skeleton?
Only partially. So there were bones that could not be identified to a specific skeletal element, but there was so much missing that was not accounted for. So I believe there are a large amount of these remains that are actually missing, but a small amount are bones that I could not identify what they were.
So you reviewed the testimony of the excavation of the site with a bulldozer. Is that correct?
I did review the reports on the excavation of the remains.
And that they used a bulldozer and took care to try to locate all of the remains. Is that correct?
I believe so, yes.
And yet they didn't have the remains.
I don't know where the missing remains are, so I can't comment on
that. But in fact, you don't have all of the remains, correct?
That is correct.
And you believe that the remains cannot be determined to have been burned out or disappeared as a result of a fire. Is that correct?
Not entirely. Yes, that's correct.
And there are bones missing?
Yes.
Okay. Significant amount of bones missing, right?
Yes, you can see from the skeletal diagram, everything in black was not identified in the remains.
Now, I want to continue with your report. Were you able to make a determination as to whether the body was burned in its being intact?
Based on the burn pattern, I do believe that the most likely possibility is that the body was burned as a whole, not in pieces.
Okay. And would it be fair to say you can't make a determination as to the length of time it would take to burn the body?
We could only provide sort of minimum time frames, but there's, you know, how much fuel is used, the size of the body, and other factors all can alter those parameters.
So there's no definitive way to determine how long it took to put Tylee's remains in the manner in which they were found. Is that correct?
That is correct.
In addition, there were some fragments, and I want to use the word fragments because in the fire pit, there were some objects that were removed from the fire pit. Do you recall seeing that?
Yes.
Are you able to determine what type of fragments those are?
Most of the bones that were in the fire pit lack diagnostic characteristics, so they could not be identified as being either human or animal.
Right. So we don't know what those fragments were. Would that be fair?
That is correct.
Okay. You noted that there was a canine mark on part of the remains of Tylee. Is that correct?
That was not something that I noted, but had been noted by the anthropologist with the FBI.
Okay. And do you recall the location of that canine mark offhand?
I believe it was on one of the shoulders, so where the shoulder connects to your shoulder blade. I don't remember if it was on the left or right side, but it's we made those observations and did not see evidence of scavenging, but sometimes making those determinations is very challenging.
Okay. And I said canine, I meant carnivore.
Yes.
So we don't know when a carnivore may have made those marks on the body. Is that correct?
We do not, and I'm not certain if they're carnivore marks or related to the burning process.
Okay. I want to talk to you about whether you can make a determination as to where Tylee Ryan's body was burned.
I cannot make that determination.
So in other words, you can't make the determination that her body was burned on Chad Daybell's property. Is that correct?
I cannot make that determination.
And you can't make a determination as to the day or time that the body was burned. Is that correct?
That is correct.
What you can make a determination is that the body was burned intact to your best opinion. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And you can't make a determination as to whether the body was burned and then at some subsequent time placed in Chad Daybell's backyard. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Judge, I have nothing else at this point.
All right. That'll conclude the direct examination then. Mr. Wixom, I presume, will be doing cross. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Good morning, Dr. Bartolink.
Good morning.
And am I saying that correctly? It's Bartolink?
You pronounced it perfectly.
Thanks. So, Dr. Bartolink, you've already, I think, shared with the jury that in preparing and in conducting your own analysis of Tylee's remains,
you looked at the autopsy report that had been done on Tylee. Is that true?
That is correct.
Likewise, I think you've indicated that you did review the FBI reports from Dr. Angie Christensen and a report from Dr. Halapaska. Is that true?
I did, yes.
Okay. And you have a professional relationship, or at least a collegial relationship, with Dr. Angie Christensen, don't you?
That's correct.
In fact, I believe you both published something together.
We are co-authors on a textbook.
Okay. So is it fair to say that she is a colleague that you have respect for?
Judge, I'm an object witness bolstering.
Sustained.
When you reviewed her report and Dr. Halapaska's report, didn't you indicate in your own that when you compared your findings with theirs and with the autopsy, that you found no substantive difference in the analysis of Tylee's bones?
That is correct.
And you were asked a question by the defense about the ability to estimate a time with which it took to burn Tylee's remains. And I think you concluded that that's not possible. Is that right?
There are just too many variables that are unknown, so I would not feel comfortable making any kind of determination.
In fact, in your report, wasn't that a question that you were specifically asked by the defense in preparation of your analysis?
Yes.
Okay. And the question was, can you burn Tylee's bones within a 2-hour period? That's the question.
That was the question, yes.
Okay. And as I recall from your report, you said it's possible, but you can't determine that. Is that fair?
That is correct.
Likewise, I think you were just asked a question about the ability to determine whether or not Tylee's remains had been burned on the Daybell property. Do you recall that question?
Yes, I believe I do.
And I think you answered that it's not possible to make that determination, correct?
That is correct.
So is it fair then to say that it may well have been that her remains were burned on the Daybell property?
Judge, objection, offer speculation.
Well, overruled.
You may answer.
It's certainly possible that she could have been burned on the property, but it's also possible that she could have been burned elsewhere.
Fair. I think you indicated that you've already indicated that not all of the bones from Tylee's remains were found by the FBI or the search who conducted it, correct?
That's correct.
And you can't tell whether or not all of the bones have been entirely burned out because you don't have all of the bones. Is that fair?
Yes. In my experience, we still would expect to find large portions of the bones that were missing even after the burning process has completed. But there are some bones that were just too fragmented to identify. So some of those could just be those bones, but there's still quite a lot not accounted for.
And didn't you indicate in your report at some point that it's possible there are still bones that remain on the Daybell property?
It's judge, objection, speculation.
Overruled.
That is a possibility.
And just to be clear, it's true that there were many of the remains that you analyzed that were subject to thermal damage, correct?
That is correct.
They had been burned.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. And in fact, you had found a number of the remains to have had blunt force trauma. Is that correct?
That is correct. Blunt force defects consistent with perimortem trauma.
Yes. And with respect to defects, in fact, didn't you find that the left mandible, I'm going to call it the jawbone if that's not correct. Let me know.
That is correct.
Okay. That the left mandible had been fractured. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I think in 6 different places.
I can't remember the number of places, but there were fractures to the left side of the mandible.
And you did determine that that had been from a blunt force trauma?
Yes, although unable to tell if it's before or after death.
So you can't make the perimortem versus postmortem distinction, but you still believe it was blunt force trauma?
Correct.
Likewise, I think you determined in your analysis that there was blunt force trauma on the skull, the sternum, and the ribs. Is that right?
That is correct.
And there were sharp form defects in the innominates, or the hip bone. Is that right?
That is correct.
The sacrum.
That is correct.
And the cervical spine.
The ones on the cervical spine are possible sharp force defects, but could not make a definitive determination on those.
And with respect to the sharp force defects, you did indicate that you can't exclude, as some of the instruments that may have caused those, to have been either a shovel or a pickaxe, correct?
That cannot be excluded. I believe I provided a long list of possible implements.
And in fact, I think you confirmed that some of those traumas could have been from a chopping force. Is that right?
That's correct.
And you indicated a machete may have been used.
That can't be excluded.
And I think finally, you had indicated that there had been some rib fractures. Is that right?
Yes, I believe there were at least two rib fractures documented in the report.
And you likewise believe that they were likely caused from blunt force trauma?
Yes, consistent with blunt force trauma.
Finally, I think in your report, you indicated that there were approximately a total of 18 sharp force defects in Tylee's bones, as well as a minimum of 16 impacts that were possible paramortem impacts on Tylee's bones. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you, sir. Your Honor, I have no more questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wixom. Mr. Pryor, you can conduct redirect if you'd like.
And thank you, Your Honor. There is no distinguishable way to determine the location, I mean, the specific place where this blunt force trauma took place, is there?
And there's not.
Judge, I have nothing else. Thank you.
All right. That will conclude then the testimony of Dr. Bartolink. So I'll inquire next, counsel, if he's to remain under your subpoena, Mr. Pryor.
He is not, Judge.
It's not that. Okay. You are released then from the subpoena. Thank you for appearing and testifying. You can be excused. All right. Mr. Pryor, does the defense have a next witness to call?
Judge, could we have a sidebar just very briefly?
Yes. All right. Thanks, everyone. At this stage of the proceedings, then, we do need to take up another issue outside of the presence of the jurors. And although it's a little sooner than typical, I think given that this will take a few moments, it's just logical to have the jurors take the mid-morning recess. We'll take this matter up outside of the presence of the jurors. And so we will have that, and then we'll take a break as well at the end of the matter we take up outside the jurors' presence. So if we could have the jury excused at this time for the mid-morning break, we'll do that now.
All right, please.
All right, thank you. Please be seated. All right, we're on the record now. Outside of the jury's presence, the courtroom's still here in these proceedings. After sidebar with counsel, the court's been advised that at this point, the defense does not intend to call any further witnesses. So I guess the remaining issue or question to address would be whether or not the defendant's going to testify. Mr. Pryor, is that the status of where things stand with the defense case in chief?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Daybell, I will instruct you that there is going to be a jury instruction in this case the court's going to give. It states, and I'm paraphrasing, that you do have a constitutional right not to be compelled to testify. The instruction will say the decision whether to testify is left to the defendant, acting with the advice and assistance of the defendant's lawyer. The jury will be instructed not to draw any inference of guilt from the fact the defendant does not testify, and the jury will be instructed not to discuss or enter into deliberations the issue of the defendant chooses not to testify. If, in fact, you are going to testify, then, Mr. Daybell, there's a further admonishment or advisement I would give you going forward. So let me begin with Mr. Pryor and just inquire whether or not you have discussed with your client whether or not he intends to testify.
I have discussed that matter with Mr. Daybell, Your Honor.
All right. And does he intend to offer testimony in this trial?
He does not.
All right. Mr. Daybell, have you, in fact, discussed that issue with your attorney?
Yes.
And has he advised you of your right to either testify or not be compelled to testify in this trial?
He has.
All right. And it's your decision to not testify. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. I appreciate you clarifying that with the court outside the presence of the jury. So with that, then, we'll take our morning recess, and I will ask the defense then in the presence of the jury if they rest their case. And again, the court will provide the instruction to the jurors that they may not consider the decision of the defendant not to testify in their deliberations with that instruction that will be provided. So we'll take the mid-morning recess, and let's come back on the record in about 15 or 20 minutes, and we'll continue with further witnesses from the state if there are any in the defense resting.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
You need to use the rest.
All rise. Folks, please grab all of your belongings as you head out. Return at the top of the hour and 30 minutes.
Thank you. Please be seated. All right. Thanks for your patience, everyone. We've been tending to a bunch of administrative things this morning while the jurors have been in recess. We are back on the record at this time. If you'll give me just a moment. So going on the record on CR 2221-1623, State of Idaho versus Chad Guy Daybell, the courtroom's open, public present. The jurors are not here. While the jurors are not present, I understand, first of all, the defense intends to rest, and in order just for efficiency, perhaps out of order here, there was an issue that came up with a proposed state's witness that would be testifying this morning. And I think in the interest of time and avoiding a subsequent break, if the parties don't have any objection, I'd like to take up that matter if we could on the proposed testimony of Deputy Cannon, I believe, is the witness. If there's something to discuss or determine outside the jury's presence, perhaps, I don't know if counsel's discussed that, but that was the information I got. So, Mr. Wixom, is the state intending to call him after the defense rests?
Yes, he would be our next witness if the court allows.
Okay. And where it's going to be your witness, Mr. Wixom, if you could just make a proffer to the court about what you think may be the issue, and then I'll see if the defense has any either motion or response to his further testimony and your case in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I might just do three things. One is what we think he'll say, why we think it's important that we be allowed to call him to say it, and then some legal authority that we think the court can look to.
All right. And before I guess we get there, I should confirm, Mr. Pryor, any objection to taking up that issue out of order before you rest?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. So, Mr. Wixom, then if you'd like to proceed with the points you were going to make, I'll hear from the defense after that.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the first point, what we believe that Deputy Cannon will testify to if you allow him to be called again is that back on October 9th of 2019, when he responded to the attempted shooting call regarding Tammy Daybell, he will testify, and I suspect adamantly, that at no time was he ever shown anything on a computer screen, any pictures. In fact, he'll testify he didn't even set foot, as I recall, into the house. If he did, it was just barely through the doorway. That's the first point of a factual point. The second factual point that he would testify to is that in responding, he was in fact approached by Joe Murray, who did tell him that Joe was outside and heard Tammy scream. And so those are the two factual points. We believe that it's important because we've heard testimony very recently from Garth Daybell and from Joe Murray that we feel like we need to rebut on those very points, to contradict those points. The concern I'm sure the defense and the court will have, and we recognize it as a concern, is that we've already called Deputy Cannon. He did not testify to those points before. Well, he certainly did not testify to the point it'd be shown on the computer screen. I don't have the record of his earlier testimony, so I don't want to speak out of turn, but I don't recall that he testified as to the issue of hearing Joe hearing Tammy scream. Your Honor, with the first issue of not being shown anything on a computer screen, that first came up after we released Deputy Cannon. So he was released. So he's not subject to the formal exclusionary order. We see this as a potential issue for possible taint. When he was released, he went back home. He did listen in part to Detective Kai Kamano's testimony. And I think there was a second witness that he had listened to. During Detective Kai Kamano's testimony, I think it was cross, he was asked about the issue of whether or not a picture of a paintball gun on a computer screen had been relayed or shown to Deputy Cannon. Deputy Cannon heard that, and I'll be candid, contacted our office immediately and wanted to come set the record straight. Well, he just heard testimony, so we saw that as an issue. I think we may have even approached that off the record of the court.
we didn't call him back in our case in chief. But now the defense has put on this evidence. And on the first point, if the court might recall, and again, I don't want to mischaracterize how the testimony came in, but when I was cross-examining Joe Murray on the point about whether or not Joe had heard Tammy scream and had been outside, I had even opined, leaving the door open directly in my questioning, to the fact that Deputy Cannon may simply have misheard or got something wrong as a mistake. And the witness was very adamant that he did not accept that as reality. He thought it was intentionally inaccurate information. So effectively, Deputy Cannon, his character has been attacked. He's been called a liar in front of the jury. So he wishes, and I think understandably so, whether that's a big factor for this court, he wishes to be able to come and to offer what he believes is the truth, which is simply that that never happened. Now, going to the Tane issue, I should further tell Your Honor that he, when he contacted us after his testimony, we instructed him to stop watching the trial and listening, and he did. After so much time passed and then our case rested, he began listening again, and he listened to Garth Daybell's testimony as well as Joe Murray's. So I need to disclose that. As being pointed out, in our case in chief, we did try to formally call him back, and I think we addressed it with the court, and we were not allowed because he had been listening to testimony, and we understand that. Why we think it's different and why it would be unusual, Judge, is first of all, we looked to Idaho Rule of Evidence 615. It says, at a party's request, the court may order witnesses excluded so that they cannot hear other witnesses' testimony, or the court may do so on its own. But the court has full discretion to decide what to do in this instance. Then I would further just point to the court to a rule I don't often hear cited in legal proceedings, but it's nonetheless there. Rule 102 of the Idaho Rules of Evidence stands for the very basic proposition that these rules should be construed so as to administer every proceeding fairly, eliminate unjustifiable expense and delay, and promote the development of evidence law to the end of ascertaining the truth and securing just determination. The state's position is that, particularly with that first point, it simply is not true that Deputy Cannon was showed any pictures of a paintball gun on a computer screen. And frankly, on the second point, Your Honor, Deputy Cannon his character has been attacked. He's been called a liar. And so we feel like in the interest of trying to ascertain the truth and to secure a just determination on these very narrow issues that we should be allowed to call Deputy Cannon. I will note to the court, I did go back and look at an October 9th report from Deputy Cannon and then a further subsequent report of an interview of Deputy Cannon by the AG's office. And there's nothing in there that contradicts what he might testify to. Frankly, if it never happened, there'd be no reason to see any reference in the report that he was shown any pictures in a computer screen because he said it never happened. So that's really where we're at, Judge. We understand that there's an issue. He has watched testimony. We do think on these very narrow points that the court should allow us to call him.
All right. Just to clarify there, Mr. Wixom, in prior testimony, and I'm, of course, thinking back over it as well, but you said a couple of times, he's been called a liar. I don't know that the term he's a liar came out in testimony, did it?
No, I agree. That was just a characterization.
So there's been a clear contradiction, you could say, in testimony between two witnesses. I wanted to make sure I didn't recall hearing anyone refer to him as a liar other than an argument here. Is that accurate?
He never used that word, Judge, but as I recall, his characterization of Deputy Cannon's version of the facts was that there had been some intentional inaccuracy. I'll leave it at that. But he did not use an inflammatory word like liar. He did not do that.
Okay, thank you. All right, Mr. Pryor, then there's a proposal by the state in their rebuttal case to call witness Deputy Cannon. You've heard the argument and understand, I'm sure, the issues here, and also that he's also been listened to subsequent testimony. What's the response from the defense on this proposed witness testimony?
Well, Judge, there's a couple of things I'm still a bit confused about. They're going to suggest that in no time, one, that Deputy Coulter viewed a video that was claimed that he viewed. Is that one, Mr. Wixom?
Yeah, I'm not sure that it was a video, but I think the testimony from your witness.
Computer.
Yeah.
It was a Google search.
Google search. Yeah. And two, at no time that Deputy Coulter was inside the home. Is that what the other one?
I believe that what he would say is he had just put his foot into the door and just barely crossed the threshold, but he didn't go inside the home to talk to anybody other than Tammy.
Okay. So Judge, one of my concerns is this, is that we went over his statement at the time of his testimony on cross.
And one other point there, there's a second also statement about him talking to with Joe Murray and whether he heard a scream. I think that someone said that she screamed or he heard a scream. So that's a separate issue as well that you can address if you'd like. Sorry to interrupt.
And Joe and Judge, one of the difficulties, Your Honor, is this, is that, you know, in reviewing Officer Coulter's report, the very first sentence of his report, and I quote, "On October 9th, 2019, at 21:40 hours, I was talking to Tamara Daybell in her front room of her home." So for Officer Coulter now to say, well, you know, I only just stepped in. Well, that's not what that's suggesting. The first sentence says he was talking to her. And lo and behold, Judge, that computer is in the front room of the home. And he was there long enough to then identify the fact that Garth and Chad were at the front door leading into the kitchen. The concern I have is this, Judge, is that this witness was called, he was cross-examined, and there was the ability to recross. And now what's happening is they don't like the tone of what was testified to, and the evidence isn't favorable to them. So what they're going to do is engage throughout this rebuttal in a process of trying to discount everything that we've presented in our case in chief. And they're going to start with Officer Coulter and pick these little things that they can differentiate. And they shouldn't be allowed to do it. That's not what rebuttal is all about. They can challenge evidence, but they've excused this witness. They've excused this witness, and this witness has now been tainted by looking at all of this other evidence, by reviewing all of this other evidence. And Judge, you're right. I never called Deputy Coulter a liar. Did I challenge his accuracy of what he said? Absolutely. That's my job, to challenge witnesses as to what their statements are. And the state had a chance to recross, and they elected not to go forward any further and inquire. And now after the case is over, it's sour grapes. And they don't like what has been presented, and they've got to figure out a way to try to punch holes in any little thing they can. The only problem is this witness has already been tainted. So tainted, Judge, that he's offended by Mr. Wixom's own statement that in some way I've somehow called him a liar. Well, that sounds to me that we don't have a witness who's going to get up there and say, anything that's consistent with his report. What he's going to try to do is prove that he's not a liar. And that's not what this was designed to do. Rebuttal is a whole other purpose. And on the issue of 615, Judge, and excusing witnesses, that's designed when a case starts and by motion, either party can make a motion to excuse witnesses. That has nothing to do with after the state rests their case and suddenly they decide that, oops, we shouldn't have released Officer Coulter. And now on second thought, let's bring him back and let's take another crack at the defense's presentation of evidence. I wholly object to this tactic. And if the court opens this door, you're going to open the door to a litany of rebuttal that could go on for days. And it's highly inappropriate.
All right. Mr. Wixom, any responsive argument before I make a ruling here?
Very quickly, Judge. Frankly, Judge, it's certainly not a tactic. Rebuttal is something built into the rules, built into the system. It's part of a litigation of a criminal case. With respect to some more specific points, the state can't anticipate when we do release a witness that inaccurate testimony is later going to be offered by the defense. And that's what we think happened, particularly of the questioning of Detective Caicomano. In fact, as I recall, I think it was defense counsel who offered that. No witness did. He offered that in a cross question, this idea of being shown something on a computer screen. We can't anticipate that coming in. And so, certainly not a last-minute tactic. What we have is a situation where evidence has came in that our witness was not directly cross-examined on or directly examined on. We couldn't foresee that these kinds of questions would come up because our position is they simply aren't true. And so we believe that we're simply applying the basic function of rebuttal, which is to consider evidence that's presented by the defense and then responding to it. That's what rebuttal testimony is. I will acknowledge again to the court, I think the fair concern is whether or not his testimony may have been tainted now by the fact that he's listened to more other portions of this case. We don't think he will be. If the court has questions, he's available for questioning by the court on the stand to explore whether or not he's been tainted and to voir dire him or the defense counsel if the court permits that. So we certainly, we do believe that these are things that need to be addressed. We didn't have a fair chance to address them. That's what rebuttal's for. We don't think he's been tainted. And so we simply ask the court to give us the opportunity.
All right. Well, I'm considering this. I will note a couple of things. First of all, in terms of the propriety or impropriety of calling him in rebuttal, I do agree with the state's argument here that in a case, the state bears the burden. And so it is the state that's allowed an opportunity for rebuttal witnesses to come in and testify. In this instance, there were some narrow topics that came up in the course of the defense case in chief, which are subject to rebuttal, including this issue of whether or not there was, you know, showing of pictures on a Google search in the residence, as was testified to contradictorily between the witnesses, and also comments that the deputy said, including whether someone said they heard a scream. So it's not improper in any way to allow for rebuttal of those statements. The thing the court is weighing a little more cautiously here is whether or not now the court should permit the witness to return after the witness has been observing or listening in on the testimony. And the court would note that the exclusionary rule under 615 governs that. It's discretionary with the court. There's a lot of cases out there that say that. State versus Slauson, 124 Idaho 753, the granting or denying of a request for exclusion under 615 is a discretionary decision of the trial court. And whatever the remedy is also up to the court in its discretion, according to State versus Christensen, 100 Idaho 631. So I don't have any hesitation determining that this would be appropriate rebuttal. The real question then is whether or not the witness testimony has potentially been tainted, where the witness, having been released by the state, observed the trial proceedings, and you know the witness would be placed under oath and sworn to tell the truth. So I'm not making any speculation that Deputy Coulter Cannon would not just come in and tell the truth, but the observation of that trial testimony on those very points is somewhat concerning, where the court ordered an exclusionary order for the witnesses when this case started because of the manner in which public access has been provided and the whole case has been live streamed. And essentially, when witnesses are permitted to view and listen to other testimony, whether they do it intentionally or subconsciously, there's certainly an opportunity for a witness to know, you know, exactly what they're going to be asked about, how they would respond to that, think through what some other witness said. And in a typical trial, you just wouldn't be allowing the witness to sit in and watch other witnesses to prepare for additional testimony. So quite honestly, I have vacillated back and forth on this second part of whether or not his observation of the testimony should result in him being excluded from offering this rebuttal testimony. Clearly, the door was open by the testimony that was given in the defense case in chief. But upon weighing out the discretionary function the court has here and looking at whether or not I think there might be some prejudice that could result from allowing the witness to return and testify after hearing the contradictory testimony does cause me some real concern. And so because, and I very much appreciate the candor of the state in revealing that Deputy Cannon has listened to the testimony, which further goes to me indicating I think he's clearly an honest in the testimony he's provided at trial in terms of at least what he's testified to under oath and his recollections, as well as notifying by proffer to the state and again to the court that he has in fact heard some of this testimony. So I have no reason to personally question his credibility, but again, the ability to have heard that testimony, and even if it's subconsciously, just being allowed to prepare for that, I think ultimately is at least an appearance of impropriety or perhaps an unfair advantage a witness would have if they took the stand on those very issues, knowing exactly what somebody else testified to. So the court is going to not permit his testimony in the case in rebuttal on those topics, not because they're improper rebuttal, but because in this particular instance on these particular topics, he was able to know precisely what was testified to. And with the defense objection, I think it is proper that the jury will be just left to consider not which version of the events they do believe. So for that reason, I am going to grant the motion of the defense to exclude the testimony of Deputy Cannon. So that's going to be the court's ruling on that issue. Mr. Pryor, do you have any questions on that?
No questions, Judge.
Any questions from the state?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, counsel, for bringing that up to my attention outside the presence of the jurors. At this time, then, we'll go ahead and bring the jurors back in. And then is the state going to have additional rebuttal witnesses today?
Yes, Your Honor. We're prepared to call another witness.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. We'll have the jurors return to the courtroom then. And then, Mr. Pryor, where we left off is without you having yet rested. So I'll bring up that issue in the jurors' presence, and then we'll proceed if there's rebuttal witnesses by the state this morning.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, please. Please, President Counter, for Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Please be seated. Okay. We're back on the record now on KCR 2221-1623, State of Idaho versus Chad Guy Daybell. We had a morning recess. It went much longer than anticipated, but we were conducting some court matters outside the presence of the jurors, and as well as other matters that led to the break being extended. So I appreciate everyone's patience as we move through the morning. When we left off, I had inquired whether or not the defense had another witness to call at this time in its case in chief. Mr. Pryor, does the defense have another witness at this time?
There will be no further witnesses, Your Honor. Defense at this time rests its case.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Pryor. At this time, then, what occurs next is an opportunity for the state to present any rebuttal testimony through rebuttal witnesses. Does the state intend to call any rebuttal witnesses?
We do, Your Honor. At this time, we're prepared to call Lisa Marie Jensen.
Very well. If you want to call your rebuttal witness, then we'll have that witness brought in and sworn.
I solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. Yes.
Okay.
If you have the mic, it's a little bit over your chips.
Thank you.
All right. At this time, Ms. Jensen's been sworn. Before we have further testimony on rebuttal, Mr. Wixom, I am going to inquire on the court's exclusionary order. Ma'am, have you observed any of the trial testimony that's occurred since this case started?
No, I have not.
Okay. Have you talked to anyone else about any testimony they have given in trial?
No.
Okay. Thanks for your responses. Mr. Wixom, if you'd like to inquire on direct, you may.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ma'am, will you please state your full name for the record and spell it?
Lisa Marie Jensen, LisaMarieJensen.
Thank you. And can you please tell the jury, where is it that you live?
I live in Sugar Salem, Idaho.
And what do you do for a living?
I am an educator at Central Elementary.
Okay. And where is that school at?
In Sugar Salem, Sugar City.
Do you know a Tammy and an Emma Daybell?
Yes, I do.
Tell the jury how you know them.
I run our Title I department, and I supervise paras, and I hired Emma as one of my paraprofessionals before she was hired as a third grade teacher. So we worked together, and Tammy Daybell was our librarian and computer specialist.
And I want to draw your attention back to 2019, particularly the beginning of the school year. During that time frame, was Tammy someone who you would regularly interact with or see at the school?
Yeah.
Can you explain what occasions you'd have in the line of your work to interact with her?
Yeah, we didn't, our jobs didn't align necessarily. She was the librarian. Many people often think, oh, you're the reading specialist, so you must work closely. But we just were mostly friends and colleagues at the school.
Did you see her do her work at the school?
Yeah.
How often would you see her doing her work?
A couple times a week.
Okay. And what kinds of things do you recall observing her do while she was working?
She ran our library. She did our computer specialist. She was our go-to. If there was something that needed to be done and we didn't know who to do it, Tammy was our girl.
Did you have a chance to observe any physical activities that she did in her work?
Judge, I'm going to object at this point. It's going beyond the scope.
Overruled. You may answer.
Will you repeat the question?
Did you have an opportunity to observe any physical activities that Tammy did at her work?
Just normal day-to-day physical activities, yes.
Could you describe some of those things to the jury, please?
As educators, we're just on our feet a lot. She was back and forth between the library and the computer lab. She also did recess duty, so she was just all over the school a lot. She was busy.
Overall, do you feel like you had the opportunity to make general observations about her health and wellness?
Sure.
What did you observe about Tammy?
About her health?
Yes, ma'am.
That she was well and healthy, and she strived to keep herself that way.
Judge, I'm going to object at this point without any additional foundation.
Overruled.
Any other observations about her health?
She was well.
Okay. You just used the word, she strived to keep herself that way. Can you explain to the jury what you meant by that word?
Yeah, she... every day, she, even if she had on a dress, she would wear her tennis shoes. I loved that. She aimed to get steps in. She participated in exercise classes.
I'm going to object at this point without some additional foundation.
I'll sustain that.
You just mentioned something about steps in. Can you explain to the jury what was the observation that you made? And when did you make it about seeing Tammy get her steps in?
I don't know when I would have made that observation, just in the time that I knew her, but she would wear a Fitbit. She exercised frequently.
Judge, I'm going to object at this point and move to strike. There's no foundation to support that.
It's overruled. You can cross on that, Mr. Pryor.
Did Tammy ever, particularly during that last few weeks before her passing, did she ever complain about being sick or feeling unwell?
No.
Do you remember her missing work at all?
No.
In the context of observing her do her work, the physical aspect, did you ever notice her to get tired or exhausted?
No.
Did she ever seem winded to you?
No.
Your Honor, at this time, I have a line of questioning that may involve an evidentiary issue. I think it can get resolved in a sidebar. I don't think it should be brought up in the presence of the jury, but may I ask to have a sidebar?
Yeah, we can have a quick sidebar, counsel.
There's more to come in the trial of Chad Daybell. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage right here from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.